Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. To many listening to this program, the Vietnam War may seem like ancient history. While it ended almost half a century ago, there are some ways in which it is still with us. The Tet Offensive of 1968 was part of a massive effort on the part of communist forces to end the war. The world was stunned by the brazen effort. The Battle of Hue was central to the plan. And the story of that battle is told by our guest, St. Louis native author Mark Bowden. His book is Hue, 1968. It's the latest in a long string of his bestsellers, the best known of which is Black Hawk Down, which outlined tragic consequences of American involvement in the civil war in Somalia. I'm happy to welcome Mark Bowden back to the studio with us, your third visit with us, Mark.
Thank you, Don. Always glad to be in St. Louis.
Great to have you here. You know, you and Ken Burns are putting Vietnam back on the map these days.
Yeah, you know, and it was fortuitous for me in a number of ways. You know, the series obviously has piqued a lot of people's interest in Vietnam, but also I became friendly with Lynn Novick and Sarah Botstein, the producers of that show, when I was working on this book, and they were very helpful to me.
Yeah. You know, when you look back on the year 1968, what a year it was. I mean, you had the assassination of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. Richard Nixon was elected president. Lyndon Johnson decided he wasn't going to run for president. You had the Democratic Convention, and the year started with the Tet Offensive.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly.
What's the significance of that offensive?
You know, it's hard to overstate its significance. The Vietnam War was something that I think had been sold to the American people as something that could be over quickly and readily accomplished. General Westmoreland had come back to the United States at the end of 1967 and basically predicted that it would all be over soon and American troops would be coming home. And then the enemy, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong, launched attacks on every major city and town in South Vietnam simultaneously and took the city of Hue. So it certainly put a lie to the official version of events about what was going on in Vietnam. I think it kickstarted the anti-war movement into the mainstream. As you mentioned, within weeks of this being over, Johnson decided not to run. Westmoreland was withdrawn. I don't think as a country we've ever gone back to the place we were before this.
What was the significance of Hue itself, the city itself?
Well, when Vietnam was one country, which was through most of its existence, Hue was the capital. Mm-hmm. And so it had a tremendous cultural symbolic importance. And I think the North Vietnamese knew this. And when they took Hue, which was at the time the third largest city in South Vietnam, it had a resonance in South Vietnam that would have been lost on most Americans. It was a cultural center, the historical capital of the home of Hue University, which was the big university in the country. So it had a big impact.
I remember this period fairly well. And what I remember most vividly was the fact that all of the attention during this offensive was put on Saigon and what was going on in Saigon.
Yeah.
Very little mention early on about Hue.
Right. For the simple reason that that's where all the American reporters were.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, the action at the American embassy in Saigon was literally like across the street from where all the correspondents had their bureaus. And it took a few days before the press woke up to the fact that there was a huge battle being fought up in Hue and that, in fact, the entire city of Hue had been taken.
You dedicate your book to one of them, the New York Times reporter, Gene Roberts, right?
Right.
Why Gene Roberts? Why dedicate the book to him?
Well, for a couple of reasons. You know, I didn't even know that Gene had been in Hue during this battle. I ran into him early on in working on this book and told him what I was doing. And he said, well, you know, I was there. And it turned out, you know, as I began to investigate the story, that, you know, the whole city of Hue was taken. And yet the military command in Saigon insisted it had not happened. Essentially, General Westmoreland told the public and cabled the White House and the Joint Chiefs that there were about 500 enemy soldiers in Hue and they would quickly be routed. And in fact, there were 10,000. So he was off by a factor of 20. Mm. And, you know, Gene Roberts, partly serendipitously, he had gone to Da Nang thinking that there was going to be a big attack at Da Nang and nothing happened there. And everyone in Da Nang said, you know, there's something really big going on in Hue. So he landed in the middle of this battle. And within the first few days, he was reporting on the front page of the New York Times the truth of what was going on. Mm-hmm. And it was stark opposite of what the official version of events was. So I was really impressed with his reporting, with the stories that he wrote, and then coupled with the personal connection. He had hired me many years earlier to be a reporter at the Philadelphia Inquirer. It was an opportunity to kind of recognize him.
You know, one of the things, I'm halfway through the book and I'm enjoying it immensely.
Thanks, Tom.
Although it is so vivid in some of your description about the combat that it's almost like watching a movie. Mm-hmm. And it may be, as I understand, we'll talk about that more a little bit later. But most impressive to me is the amount of research, Mark, that you did and were able to get. I mean, you've talked to people on both sides of this battle and a lot of them, and you have quotes from people that are going back 50 years of recollection. Where did you find these people? How did you gather all this stuff and put it together?
Well, thank you. I build these stories from the ground up. I'm more a journalist than a historian. Even though I use an historian's methods, I rely on firsthand accounts. And it was relatively easy to find American veterans of the Battle of Hue. Once you know which units were engaged, they have websites now and they list rosters of members. So I was able to penetrate that fairly quickly. In Vietnam, it was a little harder, but I hired a fellow named Ho Dang Hoa, who was a retired military officer in Vietnam, who knew his way around the military and the kind of alumni associations or veterans groups in Vietnam. And he was able to round up members of the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese Army who had fought against Americans. And then, of course, I went to Hue and looked for civilians who were trapped in the middle of this battle.
And how cooperative were they? Obviously, you talked to many of them, but how did they react to you and the kinds of questions you were asking?
Most were very eager to talk to me. I mean, as we know, the Vietnamese won the war. The veterans of the North Vietnamese Army and the Viet Cong are celebrated for their heroism and sacrifice and they are very ready to talk about their experiences. There are things about the takeover of Hue, like the executions that were carried out by the invading communist forces, which are not readily talked about by most people. But I found that people, even though it is an authoritarian state still, and there's a certain amount of fear of the authorities, that things have loosened up enough in Vietnam now that most of the people I talked to were fairly candid about what they saw and what they heard.
You know, in thinking back to that period of time and how bloody it was on both sides, and the fact that today you're able to go to Hue and go to any place that you would choose to go in Vietnam, it really kind of reinforces what a waste that whole thing was.
It's an overwhelming feeling, and I hear that a lot from Vietnam veterans, Americans who have gone back to Vietnam and have very powerful, traumatic memories of fighting there, only to see a thriving country that treats them as friends, has a ongoing diplomatic relationship now with the United States, and it makes you wonder what it was all about.
You know, the futility of war, when you look back at our relationship now with Japan and Germany and now Vietnam, it just – why we keep getting involved in these things,
well,
never know.
At the very least, stories like this ought to underline how war should be an absolute last resort, because so many people lose when you go to war, and there are no clear winners in these things.
Well, you've documented a lot of the military. What is your thinking these days about our current adventures? I mean, we're all over the place, and people are still dying.
Yeah, and I think that what alarms me is, and Vietnam is a perfect illustration of it, is how we periodically, as a country, kind of dumb ourselves down, and we do that by ignoring the very people who we employ to learn and understand regions around the world. We send foreign officers to live in Southeast Asia and learn the language and learn the culture and learn the politics, and then we don't listen to them. Mm-hmm. And, this we see it in this present administration. They haven't even staffed most of the State Department. I think that the Trump administration wants to cut the funding for the State Department by a third. And even their own Secretary of Defense, General Mattis, says, look, if you don't have a State Department, you just might as well buy more weapons because we're going to go to war more often.
And there's a reluctance today, certainly, of people who are unwilling to believe a lot of what our military and political leaders say. And much of this started in Vietnam. You mentioned General Westmoreland. Mm-hmm. It's very clear in your book this guy was a liar. I mean, he simply made things up to look good himself and to just placate his superiors back in Washington.
You know, he was definitely someone who was so wedded to his own theory of what was happening in the world that that reality couldn't even penetrate. I mean, even his field commanders who were out in the streets of Hue fighting and radioing back exactly what they were encountering were disbelieved or were discredited, who were told, you know, you're panicking. You're mm-hmm. overreacting. You know, mm-hmm. that's not what's happening. Well, you know, I interviewed these guys, many of them now retired generals, who are still furious about the way they were being used.
And, of course, the political leaders in Washington were more than happy to believe what he was saying. I mean, sure. you bring up, as certainly you should have, the body count situation, how important it was to just have an elevated body count, and that's the way the whole thing was judged.
Yeah. And that was – we now know, you know, a huge mistake, because all it did was give everybody an incentive to exaggerate, and so the numbers became meaningless. I mean, if you went by General Westmoreland's body counts, we won the war in Vietnam at least 5 or 6 mm-hmm. years before we pulled out and gave the country over to the North Vietnamese.
We certainly learned a lesson there in underestimating the enemy, too. I have to take a break momentarily, but the idea of the way this battle was planned, that Tet Offensive was planned, is really quite remarkable because it didn't just happen.
Right.
We'll come back to that in just a moment. My guest is Mark Bowden. He's the author of Hue, 1968. We'll come back, continue our conversation. And by the way, if you are a veteran of Vietnam and perhaps even a veteran of the Battle of Hue, give us a call. We'd like to hear from you. Back in a second. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Back with Mark Bowden. We're talking about his book, Hue, 1968. Mark, give us some detail about the way this whole operation, the Tet Offensive, was planned.
Well, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong began laying plans for it early in 1967. And in the case of Hue in particular, they amassed toward the end of 67, 10,000 troops on the outskirts of the city. And they, you know, created cadres within the city and smuggled weapons into them. So they were prepared on the evening of January 31st of 1968 to launch, in addition to all the other attacks up and down the country, a complete invasion of the city of Hue. And they essentially, other than some brief firefights at the gates of the citadel, which is the enormous fortress that encloses the northern part of the city, beyond that there was very little resistance. They essentially just rolled into the city and took the United States and the South Vietnamese Army completely by surprise.
And the date was very carefully planned, that Tet, the holiday, was important to the success of this.
Right. I mean, Tet is the major holiday, the New Year's celebration throughout Southeast Asia. And in Vietnam, even during the war, they would basically stop fighting for about a week and soldiers would go home and celebrate with their families. So this offensive was planned at a time when many of the South Vietnamese troops had gone back home on furlough mm-hmm. to their families. So they encountered and Hue was not a massively fortified city anyway, and so they encountered a city that was fairly easy for them just to walk into.
Let's talk a little bit about the reporting of the war, because that's a big part of your book too, and mm-hmm. was a big part of, the way we received news of what was going on. There were some crackerjack reporters there. David Halverstam comes to mind, and there were others from the networks. Give me your sense of the role that they played in this whole thing.
Well, two things, Don. One is this was the first war where the United States military essentially let journalists go wherever they wanted to go. If you could get on military transport, you could go to wherever the action was or wherever fighting was. So that meant that there were reporters out in the field with young field commanders who would ordinarily not have the opportunity to confront General Westmoreland in Saigon with the way the tactics that were being used were actually playing out in the field. And in many cases, they weren't doing well. And they would tell the reporters. I mean, mm-hmm. these were contemporaries. So you'd have a, you know, a 26-year-old company captain who's being asked to do something that he thinks is ridiculous. And he, you know, confronts David Halberstam or Neil Sheehan or Gene Roberts and says, look, you know, this is not working. And then those reporters would go back to Washington and confront the higher command, which, of course, would deny and say that everything was working wonderfully. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing that was going on. I think that in the case of the Battle of Hue, the difference between reality and what the official position was so starkly different that a lot of reporters, including old hands like Walter Cronkite, who, you know, was the CBS anchorman who, who flew out to Vietnam to look for himself what was going on, met with Westmoreland in Saigon, who told him there was nothing of importance happening in Hue, and then went to Hue. And he witnessed a battle on the scale of something that he had seen in Europe in World War II. So he realized that the official line was not true, and he came home and delivered a very famous essay on the air to the American public saying, we're not winning this war. It doesn't look like we're going to win this war.
And LBJ reacted to that, as I recall. I haven't gotten to that part in your book yet, but as I recall, it says, if we've lost Uncle Walter, we've lost the war.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, yeah. And he knew. I mean, at the time, there were only, as you know, Don, three networks and television, yeah. Three channels. And Walter Cronkite was the most esteemed of the anchormen. And, you know, that was a huge American audience. And you had an administration that was dismissing critics of the war as pacifists and hippies and radicals. Well, Walter Cronkite was about as far as you could get from a hippie or a radical and certainly was not a pacifist.
It certainly wore Lyndon Johnson down, didn't it?
It did. And, you know, I think without question, and I write about this in the book, you know, he made the decision to not seek reelection, realizing that he was just not going to be able to sell this war to the American people anymore and didn't know how to get out of it. In that same speech, which he made on the air about 2 weeks after the Battle of Hue ended, he said he would devote the rest of his term to trying to figure out how to end the war.
Yeah. We have a caller here who wants to get into the conversation. Let's bring in Kathy. She's calling from St. Louis. Kathy, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. I love the show. I was just wondering how we fundamentally changed from Vietnam. I heard both on the show earlier and on the Ken Burns documentary and even other places that we've just never been the same, never really recovered. So I was wondering if you could talk more about that.
Sure. You know, I grew up in the 50s and 60s, and those of us who are old enough recognize that that was a kind of high point in our country in terms of the respect and faith that the American public had in its leaders, both political and in particular military leaders. The United States military in the 1950s and 60s was regarded as probably the most sophisticated and effective tool on the planet. They had won World War II in two theaters. We were, you know, for a time, the only country in the world with nuclear weapons and a nuclear arsenal. So, you know, military men and our political leaders just had a stature and a level of respect that I don't believe has ever happened since. And I think that the Tet Offensive and the Vietnam War and Watergate and these, you know, there's just been a series of blows that have left the American people, probably for the better, more skeptical of official versions of events.
What do you make of what's going on right now, the dialogue concerning the Gold Star families and what's been happening there and the things that have been said?
I think it is yet another of the tempests stirred up by popular media, social media, cable TV, talk radio. You know, I am no fan of Donald Trump. I actually know him and knew him for years before he was elected president, and I regard this as a very dark period, frankly, in American history. However, I think he called the widow of that slain soldier to try to do a nice thing, and he probably stupidly said things that were not received well. And to me, it's just, you know, one of these little tempests that I think, frankly, will drive you crazy if you pay a lot of attention mm-hmm. to them. They just, you know, they're stirred up for a week or two, and then along will come the next one. And there are, I think, far more serious issues that are at stake in this presidency than whether Donald Trump is gracious and polite, which he's certainly not.
Do you have any thoughts about General Kelly's, his chief of staff's comments yesterday in which he was defending the president?
I think, you know, my heart goes out to him. He lost his son yeah. in battle. You know, clearly a very sincere man who is, you know, he's trying to defend the man he works for, the president. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I frankly kind of agree with him. I think that, you know, you can fault Trump for a lot of things. And believe me, I do. But I don't fault him for awkwardly saying the wrong thing to a grieving widow. Mm-hmm.
Back to the book, the one of the things that has struck me so far are the number of stories that you've told about individual heroes, guys, young men who went above and beyond. I mean, they're just story after story of heroic action on these young men's part.
And I think that's because that's what happens. Mm. I think when you write about these extreme situations where people are terrified, trying to do the right thing most of the time, you get wonderful examples of people rising to the moment and doing inspiring things. You also get instances where people do terrible things mm-hmm. and disgrace themselves and the human race. But this is all, you know, part of the story. And I try as a writer to capture it all. I mean, I'm as apt to admire someone, say like Lieutenant Colonel Ernie Cheatham, who led the Marines across Southern Hui and took back that part of the city, I think, brilliantly. And at the same time that I find the actions of General Westmoreland to have been almost criminally irresponsible.
Another striking part of it was the suddenness, of course it would have to be sudden, the suddenness with which young men would suddenly be dead. I mean, they're walking down the street and then you say, and suddenly there's a bullet in his forehead.
Right.
It happened time and time and time again.
Suddenness and randomness.
Yeah.
So that, you know, there's no logic to it. I mean, you can be standing next to the most experienced, bravest soldier you've ever met in your life and he's shot down, and the guy next to you, who's the biggest goof off and lousiest soldier in the unit, you know, somehow survives. I think, you know, the randomness of it, the suddenness of it, the horror of it leaves, I think, everyone caught up in these moments scarred for life.
And the lost limbs, just again and again, it's just hard to fathom.
It is. And but I think in order to fully appreciate the heroism, you have to understand what the circumstances were. And, you know, it's one thing to bravely get up and run across the street against enemy fire. That's a brave act. But when you've seen three or four of your buddies mowed down next to you, to still get up and go, there's an even deeper level of heroism and commitment there.
Yeah, there was one story you told about two men in a foxhole. It was cold and it was damp, and they were hugging each other to try to keep warm. Mm-hmm. And the next day or very shortly thereafter, one of them was dead and died in front of the other.
Right. Yep.
It's incredible. I mean,
you would form these incredible ties with people who would be gone in the next minute. And there was never a moment where you grieved. I mean, the death of that man next to you, sometimes you wouldn't even know his name. Would resonate in his hometown and his family and his community for generations. Yeah. That was a very terrible and powerful thing when that person was killed. But in the moment, in the battle, you can't even pause to put your hand on the guy's head and wish him goodbye. I mean, you just have to keep moving to try to stay alive.
Can you imagine yourself in that kind of a situation? I cannot.
Yeah, I mean, I've tried to, and you do as you write these stories, and I certainly would never say with confidence that I would be as brave as the people I'm writing about.
Nor could I. Let's take another call or two. Marshall in Kirkwood has been waiting. Go ahead, Marshall, you're on the air.
Oh, yeah, I had a couple of quick comments. One about General Westmoreland. You mentioned about his incompetency and the fact that he was a liar. The other thing, that he was really an unqualified artillery officer who had never gone to the Army advanced courses. that would normally have led to a command position. He was really just a bad choice.
Hmm. But he looked great, you know, and he looked just like a general out of Hollywood casting. And Johnson had met him when Westmoreland was the superintendent at West Point and was very impressed with his manner and his bearing, and chose him specifically, you know, over the contrary advice of some of his advisors to take over the top position in Vietnam.
Yeah, he did look good. There's no question about it. Another call. Jim is joining us from Manchester. Go ahead, Jim. You're on the air.
Sure. How are you this morning?
Great. How are you?
I'm fine. I was in country. I went in June 28th of 67, came out June 28th of 68. And I was there for the Tet Offensive, but that's not what I want to talk about. Vietnam, as we look back, was an unnecessary war. So you got a President Bush and a President and a Vice President Cheney, and now you got another president who was 4F, and his father probably bought that because he had heel spurs. And Bush went to the Air National Guard of Texas. And if you were NG, meaning National Guard, it stood for not only National Guard, but it stood for not going. So we had two draft dodgers. And I prefix it with the letter F, and you figure out what that stands for. But Cheney and Bush lied to the American people about weapons of mass destruction. Cheney goes on Meet the Press, who had his office had leaked, and Scooter Libby, he's a convicted felon now because of it. And Cheney goes on Meet the Press and says, look, it must be true because the New York Times printed it. Well, that's fake news, as they call it now. Nobody calls this guy out. Cheney was a 2S. He was a draft dodger. And draft dodgers always want to take the country to war.
Jim, I'm going to stop you there because we're running out of time. We'll give Mark a chance to respond. I think it's part of what you were saying before about our ability or lack thereof to trust elected officials. Just continue down.
No, and it's true. And without question, as our caller is suggesting, I think having military experience, having had the experience of being to war, I think ought to be considered a valuable criteria. And it doesn't mean that we should preclude those who don't serve from higher office, mm-hmm. but we should value that experience in any candidate. And I do believe, you know, some of the most dedicated pacifists I've met are not pacifists, but some of the people most dedicated to avoiding war are people who've experienced war.
Right. Another call. Tony joins us from Wildwood. Go ahead, Tony.
Good day.
Good. Hi. Make it quick, please.
Okay. I was a draftee at Leonard Wood at Tet, and right after that, there was a huge push on for bodies. And by the way, I view the death of King and Kennedy as diversions to keep the military occupied. They really worried about violence. There were minor mutinies right after King. King was killed less than 100 hours after Johnson said he didn't want any more of this war stuff. And then when Kennedy was killed, they changed long-term routines based on that to keep people moving.
Tony, let me stop you there because time's getting away. Do you make a connection between the assassinations and any of the war stuff?
No. I mean, if there's a suggestion that somehow King and Kennedy were killed as part of a coordinated conspiracy by the United States government, I think we have very solid documentation of who and why, who killed Dr. Martin Luther King, who killed Robert Kennedy, why they did it. And, you know, people sometimes want to believe that things in the world happen for a more organized and coherent reason than in fact is true.
We've got less than a minute left. I do want to point out that we might be seeing a mini-series based on your book in the not-too-distant future. Tell us about that quickly, if you would.
Sure. The producer-director, Michael Mann, who's, you know, very, very famous for Miami Vice and for movies like Heat and Collateral, purchased the rights, has a deal with FX, the channel, to develop a 10-part miniseries. I had breakfast with him in L.A. the week before last, and he's on his way to Vietnam. So we'll see.
Any kind of a timetable you can talk about?
I would say, you know, we're talking about, Don, a 10-hour film, so I wouldn't look for this before like 2019 maybe at the earliest.
We'll certainly look for it. That is for sure. Mark Bowden, thank you so much. The book is Hue, 1968.
Thank you, Don.
Thank you. Great to see you again. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Jar Daston, and Spencer Reed. Executive producers Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.